Hi, I'm Philip Anthony Albertelli, and welcome to The Week in Doubt, episode 34. I have a very sensitive USB mic, so you may at times be able to pick up some of the noise of the New England rain we're experiencing right now. But who knows, maybe it'll add some ambiance. But what I want to talk about today is the story of a Harvard neurosurgeon by the name of Eben Alexander. Dr. Alexander claims to have had a near-death experience, and perhaps claims is the wrong word because I have no reason to doubt his sincerity. His story isn't that new. I believe he had the experience in 2008, and you may have seen his story mentioned a while back in an episode of Morgan Freeman's Through the Wormhole, which was about the afterlife. I believe it was the same episode in which they interviewed anesthesiologist Stuart Hameroff and talked to him about his theory about microtubules and the possibility of consciousness existing outside the brain. If you've been listening to the show for a while, I've talked about Hameroff's theories a couple times in past episodes. As we know, near-death experiences usually occur when someone is temporarily or clinically dead, or when they have some brush with death. In the case of Dr. Eben Alexander, I hope I'm pronouncing his first name right. I hear some people pronounce it Eben, some people pronounce it Eben. But in an interview with him that I listened to last night in preparation for the show, he referred to his son, who's his namesake, and he pronounced his son's name Eben, so I'm assuming it's Eben. My apologies if it's not. But back in 2008, he had slipped into a coma after contracting a very rare type of bacterial meningitis. The way he tells it, he was suddenly experiencing this agonizing back pain and then these terrible headaches. And then he ended up going into the coma. And there's a lot of NDEs or near-death experiences out there. They're not all that uncommon. I think what makes this one so fascinating is that the person who had the experience is a well-respected neurosurgeon who's taught at Harvard University for years. And I have to admit, for a skeptic, this one does make me quake in my boots a little, in full disclosure, because you have someone like me who's, I guess maybe I'd refer to myself as a fairly intelligent layman, but I'm certainly not a medical doctor, never mind a neurosurgeon. So when you have a neurosurgeon claiming to have had a near-death experience and claiming that it can't be explained away medically, it does give you pause, because who would know better about the brain and how it works than a neurosurgeon? And he claims that his near-death experience occurred while his neocortex was virtually non-functional. And according to this article I'm reading, the neocortex is part of the cerebral cortex, along with the archicortex and paleocortex, which are optical parts of the limbic system. In humans, it is involved in higher functions such as sensory perception, generation of motor commands, spatial reasoning, conscious thought, and language. So the doctor is claiming that the near-death experience occurred while conscious thought was basically impossible due to the state of his neocortex. And as a skeptic, I think the first thing that occurred to me was, and I actually heard Cenk Uygur and the Young Turks were covering this story, kind of echo my thoughts. Well, how do we know that the near-death experience took place while his neocortex wasn't functioning? I'm sure he wasn't able to keep track of time while in a coma. So how do we know that this was an experience that occurred while either while he was slipping into the coma while his brain was still somewhat functional, or maybe near the tail end of the experience, you know, right before he gained full consciousness or something like that. And I have to say, while I was listening to the interview, and I believe it was a show called Skeptico, and they were lucky enough to do an interview with Dr. Alexander, and he seemed very, very certain that this wasn't a product of the brain, and that he really had some kind of spiritual experience. And he claims that before the experience, he believed, as most Western doctors do, and as many secular thinkers do, that the brain is responsible for consciousness. And once the brain goes, so goes the individual self, consciousness, the soul, psyche, whatever you want to call it, the individual being and awareness, which is pretty much my thinking. And you've probably heard me espouse that on the show a time or two if you're a regular listener. But this experience has made him come to a conclusion that the brain and the mind, or spirit, are two separate things. And he seems to kind of chide people who hold the idea now that the brain itself is responsible for consciousness, or he kind of seems to think of it as this crude kind of reductionism to say that consciousness is generated by, you know, this fleshy machine with all these different parts. So back to what I was saying about time and how do we know when his experience occurred. Well, I have to admit, as confident as the doctor sounded during the interview, the one time when he did seem a little unsure is when the interviewer asked him the same thing. How do we know that this grand spiritual experience took place during the time when your neocortex wasn't functioning? And the doctor didn't seem to really have a solid answer. He said he tried to piece things together by matching up some of the elements of the near-death experience to times when maybe people in the real world were trying to communicate with him or talk to him. So even he doesn't seem to be entirely certain as when the NDE took place. And to me, that's pretty darn important, because that's kind of a linchpin thing. If the experience happened before he had lost higher brain functioning, or if it had happened as he was regaining higher brain functioning, then I think that gives him a lot less solid ground to stand on when he asserts that his NDE was a genuine spiritual experience, in that not just some kind of hallucinatory experience generated by an injured brain. And he describes his NDE as kind of being composed of different phases. The first phase, he says, he wasn't even really aware of being a human being or the concept of being human. It was this really kind of primitive, murky state, and he refers to it as a worm's eye view, where everything was kind of brown and ugly and murky. And then he became more aware, and everything kind of opened up into this beautiful, hyper-vivid experience. He had been accompanied by a guardian angel, and he was something like the speck on a butterfly wing, or something like that. No, I don't mean to laugh the whole thing. I'm not laughing derisively. It's just, it's so surreal. And he did say one thing where I had one of those aha moments, like, oh, it looked like he left himself open a little, where he claims, as I stated, that he now believes that the mind and the brain are two different things, or that the spirit and the brain are two different things, and that mind or the self or spirit is able to exist without the brain, outside the brain. And yet his reasoning for why the first part of his NDE was kind of crude and murky, and why he wasn't even aware of being human, really. He says that's probably because that's the best his brain could do at that moment, while it was kind of sick and quote unquote soaking in pus. Hopefully you're not eating cereal right now. but those were his words, soaking in pus. So there he seems to be kind of contradicting himself. On the one hand, he's saying that the mind doesn't need the brain. And yet he's saying his consciousness or awareness was limited due to the infirmed state of his brain. So that does seem to be a contradiction, and that's something that does give me pause. His story is actually the cover story of the newest issue of Newsweek, and the Daily Beast is a news site that's associated with Newsweek, and they have an article containing part of his account of his near-death experience. And maybe I'll read some of that, just so instead of you relying on me kind of spewing generalities about his experience, you can hear some of it in his own words. Toward the beginning of my adventure, I was in a place of clouds, big puffy pink-white ones that showed up sharply against the deep black sky. Higher than the clouds, immeasurably higher, flocks of transparent shimmering beings arced across the sky, leaving long streamer-like lines behind them. Birds, angels, these words registered later when I was writing down my recollections, but neither of these words do justice to the beings themselves, which were quite simply different from anything I have known on this planet. They were more advanced, higher forms. A sound, huge and booming, like a glorious chant, came down from above, and I wondered if the winged beings were producing it. Again, thinking about it later, it occurred to me that the joy of these creatures as they soared along was such that they had to make this noise, that if the joy didn't come out of them this way, then they would simply not otherwise be able to contain it. The sound was palpable and almost material, like rain that you can feel on your skin but doesn't get you wet. And then this is from Huffington Post. Alexander says that he traveled through this heaven surrounded by millions of butterflies with a woman. The woman gave him three messages. You are loved and cherished dearly forever. You have nothing to fear, and there is nothing you can do wrong. Eventually, the neurosurgeon awoke from the coma. He penned a book, Proof of Heaven, describing his journey. The book was due out October. The book is due out October 23rd. And actually, that account skips the quote-unquote worm's eye view portion that he says starts out the experience. Both that interview with Skeptico I listened to last night and in the episode of Morgan Freeman's Through the Wormhole, you can hear him talk about that worm's eye portion of the experience where he claimed maybe his consciousness, that kind of crude level of consciousness was all his brain was capable of supplying him with at the time, which seems to contradict his claim that the brain and consciousness are separate and that the mind doesn't necessarily rely on the meat brain, if you will. And I think another reason why I wanted to talk about this story is because it would give me an excuse to talk in some detail about near-death experiences in general. I've mentioned the subject quickly in passing in earlier episodes. I think kind of lumping them together with things like accounts of ghostly visitations and stuff like that. And that the reason why I lump them together is because they're anecdotal and as compelling or not so compelling, depending on the individual story, as they might be, that they don't really provide any empirical evidence for life after death. But I have to admit, as a skeptic, I think near-death experiences are one of the few things that can at times, to maybe some small degree, make me doubt myself. Because on the one hand, you know, who am I to question these life-changing experiences that people go through? It almost seems arrogant of me to say, hey, you know, that experience you had that was so profound and life-changing? Well, I think it was just a product of the brain, even though you who had the experience claim it was a spiritual experience. So I'm always trying to tread lightly when I cover this topic, because I myself have never had a near-death experience. And although my reason leads me to conclude that they probably do have their roots in the brain, I know that it can seem very presumptuous to try to tell someone else what the nature of their profound experience is or was. I think they also make me doubt myself, because I say, if so many people have had these experiences, maybe there's something to them. And as I said just a moment ago, who am I to say that, you know, the experiences aren't valid or they're not true? Well, I think whether they're actual supernatural or spiritual experiences, or they're just products of the brain, either way, in a sense, they're valid in that they have meaning for the people experiencing them. And one of my pet peeves about religious people is sometimes they can seem to be stubborn or irrational in the face of reason and logic and facts. Probably understandably to some degree, because no one wants to be told that their heartfelt beliefs are wrong, or if you have these kind of supernatural or religious views that are at the core of your worldview, it can be painful to have someone try to take those away. So automatically, I think you can end up being kind of guarded or defensive. And I want to make sure that I'm not guilty of the same thing. I can remember when I was a kid, maybe even all the way up until my teens and early 20s, before I really fully let go of any hope that there still might be, you know, something to the supernatural claims and the tenets of the religion that I was brought up with, Roman Catholicism in my case. Even though I had these strong doubts, I remember I would watch documentaries on the supernatural or cryptozoology. You know, it could be Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, or it could be life after death or the Shroud of Turin. I remember my gut instinct was always, oh, come on, prove it to be true, you know? I know it's probably too good to be true, but maybe at the end of the documentary, we'll find out it's for real, you know? Because it was part of me, it still wanted to believe there might be that kind of magic in the world, or there might be something more, there might be something afterwards, after this life. So my gut instinct, at least to myself, even then I was skeptical and had strong doubts, was to hope that maybe someone would come up with some kind of evidence for the afterlife, or that the Shroud of Turin was really the burial cloth of Christ, or that there is some gigantic prehistoric beast dwelling in the murky depths of Loch Ness or something like that. And now I find, nowadays, it's the opposite. Maybe I've been a non-believer for so long that I'm starting to become almost too comfortable in my unbelief, that I don't want to be proven wrong now. And so if I'm watching a show, whether it's something on the Shroud of Turin or something on near-death experiences, I automatically side with the skeptic being interviewed, and I hope that the believer won't have any good arguments, or that he'll be easily proven wrong. Probably, you know, the same as a religious person, because I have a fear of having to change my worldview or having my core beliefs challenged. So, I mean, in a weird way, I'm kind of proud of myself for at least being able to step back and realize I have this problematic thinking going on, because then I can kind of address it or stay vigilant and try to maintain my objectivity. So could there be something to near-death experiences? Might they really be the kind of adventures of the soul outside the body? Or are they just products of the of a kind of damaged, infirmed, or hallucinating brain. I mean, I'm a skeptic. That's who I am. I think I still haven't seen any really compelling evidence. I mean, this might be one of the best cases, this case of Dr. Eben Alexander. So how often do you hear about a neurosurgeon having a near-death experience and not only having one, but actually promoting the belief that they're valid in their spiritual experiences and that they can't be explained away by modern medicine or neuroscience. But still, as I think I laid out pretty well earlier, it seems like the doctor himself can't even really verify when exactly the NDE took place during his coma. He can't say for sure it happened when his brain was supposed to be relatively inactive or when his neocortex wasn't functioning. So it could have been while he still had some higher brain function capabilities, maybe before the neocortex fully stopped functioning, or maybe it happened during while he was coming out of it. And in fairness to the doctor, even he said he examined those possibilities. He tried to apply medical and scientific models to his experience, but claimed that none of them fit. But listening to him, I wasn't really convinced that there wasn't some medical explanation. As a lot of other people pointed out, I guess no matter how intelligent you are, no matter how erudite, no matter how much of a skilled physician you might be or how knowledgeable you might be in the realm of medicine, if you have a life-changing experience, often near-death experiences are said to permanently transform those who undergo them. Imagine it becomes kind of a point of reference for you. Like I said, whether or not it's a supernatural experience or it's a product of the brain, you still had that experience, and it must still seem very real and very valid. And they are valid in the sense that they have meaning for those who experience them. So it could be, in a sense, maybe the doctor's not objective enough. Yes, he's a doctor. Yes, he's a neurosurgeon, but he's also what they call a near-death experiencer. You know, he had this powerful emotional, for lack of a better word, quote unquote, spiritual experience. So in a sense, how can that not make you biased? It's interesting in a way, his experience didn't sound like the classic or stereotypical NDE experience, where often you'll hear about the tunnel of light and all these kind of hallmark experiences. His seemed much more unique or original, almost like this mind-blowing psychedelic experience. I think when I kind of put my skeptical glasses back on and take a good look at the concept of near-death experiences and try to ask myself, what is it about them that makes me doubt their validity? I think one of the things is, you know, often people say, well, there are all these hallmarks, as I just said. There's these aspects of them that you find repeated throughout different stories of people who've experienced them, such as the tunnel of light. But also, it also seems like there's a cultural filter, too. If you're a Christian, if you're a Buddhist, if you're a Hindu, a Muslim, people have experiences that reference their personal religious views or their cultural beliefs. So that right there makes you wonder a bit. If they were these empirical experiences, if they were accessing this experiential realm that all of us will access when we die, you would think that maybe it would be the same for all of us. And instead of reflecting various man-made religions, unless you want to get really creative, and there's some people who try to say that maybe heaven is different for each one of us. It's kind of tailor-fit for each one of us. And speaking of psychedelic, there is theories about how certain chemicals might be released in the brain before death that could cause these profound experiences. I'm actually reading, once you know it, once again, Wikipedia article on near-death experiences. There's a portion on biological analysis and theories. And it's talking about a study that was done or presented in 1987 by Chilean scientists, or they performed the first formal neurobiological model for an NDE, and they presented it in 1987. But somehow in the 90s, someone by the name of Rick Strassman did research involving dimethyltryptamine, which you may have heard of, abbreviated as DMT. And DMT is a super potent drug. I have never done it, but supposedly it's like taking a long, potent psychedelic trip and kind of condensing it down into this super potent half-hour experience. We can have all sorts of elaborate hallucinations. And here it says, Strassman advanced a theory that a massive release of DMT from the pineal gland prior to death or near death was the cause of the near-death experience phenomenon. Only two of his test subjects reported NDE like oral or visual hallucinations, although many reported feeling as though they had entered a similar state to the classical NDE. His explanation for this was the possible lack of panic involved in the clinical setting and possible dosage differences between those administered and those encountered in actual NDE cases. All subjects in the study were also very experienced users of DMT and/or other psychedelic entheogenic agents. Some speculators considered that if the subjects without prior knowledge of the effects of DMT had been used during the experiment, more volunteers would have reported NDE. But it's funny, I don't know what I think about his theories nowadays, although I still have affection for him, but I used to be an admirer of Terence McKenna, who is an ethnobotanist who did a lot of research as well as partaking in the use of different psychedelic plants and hallucinogenic compounds. And he used to talk about his DMT experiences, and he had experiences of going into other dimensions, communicating with these things he called, was it self-replicating machine elves or something like that. But so he was talking to these interdimensional beings. He was seeing and hearing all sorts of stuff. So I could see how why people might think that near-death experiences have something to do with the release of chemicals in the brain. And another drug I think people talk about or draw comparisons with is ketamine, which is also which is known to induce kind of dissociative experiences, feelings that one is separated from their own body, which might be similar to where sometimes in NDEs you hear about people being able to view their own body or they feel themselves leaving their own body. So I think the idea that a chemical release in the brain might have something to do with near-death experiences actually makes a lot of sense. And well, there's another theory on here that I've heard of before that actually, I have to admit, doesn't make that much sense to me. And I have to say, you know, if we're going to try to get at the truth, it's not enough just to be stuck in our own worldview and be stubborn and biased. We have to try to be critical of both sides, try to get at the truth. And if a theory that supports our belief sounds like garbage, we should still criticize it. And that garbage might be too harsh, but it seems like a bit of a stretch. And I'll quote the article. In a new theory devised by Richard Kinseher, I don't know if that's a proper pronunciation, K-I-N-S-E-H-E-R, in 2006, the knowledge of the sensory autonomic system is applied in the NDE phenomenon. His theory states that the experience of looming death is an extremely strange paradox to a living organism. As a result whereof, during the NDE, the individual becomes capable of seeing the brain performing a scan of the whole episodic memory, even prenatal experiences, in order to find a stored experience comparable to the information of death. All these scanned and retrieved data are permanently evaluated by the mind searching for a coping mechanism of the potentially fatal situation. Because people who experience NDEs report the experience of memories long considered lost, this theory necessarily depends upon a theory of memory in which all memories are indefinitely retained. Alternatively, the memories were not lost at all, but had simply been retrieved for a considerable period. The theory also states that out-of-body experiences accompanied by NDEs are the attempt by the brain to create a mental estimation of the situation and surrounding world. The brain then transforms the input into sensory organs and stored experience into a dreamlike idea about oneself and the surrounding area. I don't know if you have the same opinion as me or the same reaction, but I think that theory is a bit of a stretch. I think a chemical release in the brain or things like a brain starved of oxygen, parts shutting down, the narrowing of the field of vision, which could explain, say, the tunnel of light effect. I think things like that better explain the hallucinations and the kind of hallmark experiences of an NDE than this kind of far out but creative idea that the brain of a living creature about to experience death can't handle the paradox, so it does a whole scan of the individual's past. I don't even know how you would prove that or try to prove it. I mean, who knows? There could be something to it. I'm not a scientist, but it seems a little far-fetched. And if an NDE was the result of a brain traumatized by the paradox of being a living being that had to face its own mortality, you think maybe they might happen more when a person was awake or conscious or thinking about their own mortality than when a person's higher brain functions might not be fully operating and they're in some kind of dying state. Does an individual who's lost consciousness and dying, even though they're dying? If you got hit by a car and were hanging on by a thread or a dead and then you resuscitate or something, wouldn't at least to the outside world, you'd be out like a light? And would your subconscious brain even realize that you were dying? And if it did on some level, would it still see that as a paradox and initiate some kind of scan of your entire life's memory? I don't know. Maybe I'm looking at it wrong and there's something to it, but it seems a little far-fetched. But supposedly now with the ability to resuscitate people after cardiac arrest and the advancement of medical technology, NDEs are becoming more common because we're able to bring people back from the brink of death or even back from clinical death more frequently. But they're nothing new. I think one of the earliest, if not the earliest records of a near-death experience can be found in, I believe it's Plato's Republic, and it's known as the Myth of Er, and it talks about a soldier, a warrior, who had this kind of classic near-death experience. So I think near-death experiences, they shouldn't just be written off. Obviously, you can tell by listening to me, I'm skeptical, as I think people should be, but they're still a mystery. And I think they merit scientific investigation. And I think we don't have anything to lose. We can only gain by investigating them. If they are just products of the brain, we could probably learn a lot about the brain and consciousness by investigating them. And if they turn out to be legitimate spiritual experiences of the mind or soul, and proof that the mind or soul can exist outside the body, it'd probably be the greatest find in human history. So I think we should keep on investigating them, and there's nothing really to lose. But I think it'll be interesting to see what Dr. Eben Alexander does next. Being a neurosurgeon himself and having had one of these experiences, It'd be interesting if he could come up with any ways to try to investigate them more successfully than what's been done in the past. I hope as a neurosurgeon, he doesn't, or as a medical doctor, he doesn't kind of sit on his laurels, so to speak, and that he continues to investigate these experiences. I might disagree with him. I might be diametrically opposed in that. Being a skeptic, I tend to think that they're probably rooted in the brain, whereas he thinks it's evidence that consciousness or the mind is separate from the brain and can exist outside of the body. But either way, it's fascinating stuff, and I'd love to see what more we could learn from studying them. But you go without saying you don't have to discount these experiences just because I do. As always, I promote thinking for yourself, and this is a podcast not just for atheists and agnostics, but as the tagline says, for everyone. And if it logically makes sense to you to believe in them, and maybe even you get a sense of comfort out of these stories, then by all means, you think that these accounts are what they seem on face value, they're spiritual heavenly experiences, then don't let me deter you from that thinking. Not necessarily that I could if I wanted to. One of the things that makes life interesting is that we all have our own point of view. We all have our own beliefs. But I think whether you're a believer or non-believer, one thing we can probably both agree on is that it's a fascinating subject. But I'll let you dwell on the strange case of Eben Alexander and see what, you know, and you can decide what you think for yourself. And I guess his book comes out the end of October. So if anyone is really interested and wants to see what he has to say directly, maybe you could buy his book. And there I am once again, plugging other people's stuff. As always, this has been The Week in Doubt. You can like the show on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and look for The Week in Doubt. You can listen to the show or subscribe through Podbean. Listen or subscribe through iTunes. And any support is much appreciated.